Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. It's been 50 years since The Who put out Who's Next. That anniversary just happened. And this was a peak moment in what we'd then look back and call classic rock, which really, of course, was a radio format and not a genre. But it was a peak in some ways. It was a landmark album. It was only separated by a couple of months from Led Zeppelin IV, which was another pillar, which still is. The classic rock radio format still exists. Classic rock still exists. It's another super essential pillar of that sound, that format, that idea. 1971 was a wild year altogether for music. It also saw the release of What's Going On, which is actually the number one album of all time, according to Rolling Stone's latest list, and we talked about a lot about that particular album on the podcast last year, and also on the 500 Songs podcast. Has a whole episode devoted to it, so you should definitely check that out. But something about the confluence of those two albums, Who's Next and Led Zeppelin IV, both turning 50, seemed to merit kind of a look back at a bunch of things surrounding that and a bunch of things to talk about surrounding that. It raises a lot of discussion topics. So to help me out, I have Stephen Hyden. So Stephen's most recent book is This Isn't Happening, Radiohead's Kid A and the Beginning of the 21st Century. He also co-hosts the IndieCast podcast, and it's great to have him back. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Brian. Great to be here.
So again, there's so much to talk about here, and you know, we don't do much classic rock on this podcast, but once in a while it's good to look back. And there is that thing, like, what is and what was classic rock? You also wrote kind of a whole book about your personal experiences with that. And of course, classic rock, as I said, was a radio format and a ridiculously restrictive one. And before we talk about the greatness of some of the music involved, there's also the frustration of, you know, like, it was very, very restricted to sort of a certain idea of mostly white male rock. And, you know, you can imagine a much better format. Why wasn't there ever any P-Funk in the classic rock canon? Where was Sly and the Family Stone? Were a million things that could have fit in and expanded that. And where was Joni Mitchell? And on top of that, you know, there's also just great stuff like Big Star that could have easily fit in, right? So it's like there's this weird thing. There's great stuff in it. And then there's also a lot of, like, they also played a lot of crap that could have been replaced by a lot of the good stuff I was just talking about, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a debate when people try to define classic rock, because I think that there is this impulse, it's a revisionist impulse, to almost make it like a qualitative statement, that we're talking about like the best music of the past, and that would encompass a lot of the things that you were just talking about, like Joni Mitchell being grouped in there, Sly and the Family Stone, you know, Marvin Gaye, What's Going On, like that wasn't played on classic rock radio. Is there a more classic album from 1971 than that record? But as I think classic rock is understood in the popular consciousness, it really, I think, is tied to that radio format that began in the early 80s, that centered on this generation of bands from the 60s and 70s. Certainly The Who and Led Zeppelin are a part of that. And I think Who's Next and Led Zeppelin IV in particular are such cornerstones of that format. I mean, these are albums that I believe, like, every single song from both of those records have been played on the radio. And if you were going to start just like a boilerplate classic rock station, all you would really need are Who's Next, Led Zeppelin IV, Dark Side of the Moon, Rumors, maybe the first Boston album. And that's about it. Maybe, like, you'd play a couple songs from Frampton Comes Alive or something. But, I mean, like, those handful of albums are, like, really, I think, dominant in that format. And, yeah, you won't hear Goin' Mobile as much as Won't Get Fooled Again, but you will hear everything on that record on the radio.
Yeah, I mean, classic rock, it feels like it's been there forever, but it was actually just started by a dude named Fred Jacobs in the early 80s who noticed that there was a sort of bifurcation between younger and older audiences in what was then AOR, album-oriented rock radio. By the way, one of the, I'm sure you can relate to this, Steve, one of the things that was a real challenge to me growing up and learning about reading rock criticism and stuff was trying to understand what the hell AOR was, this thing, AOR, that, like, in the Rolling Stone Record Guide and all these other places, they'd be like, the AOR, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, it was a huge mystery to me. Like, what is, for, like, a year, what is this AOR? It sounds terrible. It must be something evil because the way they talk about it. But is it a cult? What is it? But anyway.
Right. Yeah. Well, it would be like AOR, or they might sometimes say MOR, which is middle of the road. AOR is album-oriented rock. Which was more like a 70s thing, I think. That was more part of the initial wave of FM radio that was more freeform, where they were playing sometimes entire albums, like, overnight, which wasn't really what classic rock is. Classic rock radio was much more of a regimented format, playing the same songs every day and really drilling it into people's minds.
Classic rock is the corporate ghost of AOR, basically.
Right, but it's how people like you and I came to know bands like The Who and Led Zeppelin, you know, because we're both in our 40s. I wasn't born in 1971. You know, Led Zeppelin had broken up long before I'd ever heard them. You know, Keith Moon died exactly 1 year after I was born in 1978. I was born in 77. But it was because of classic rock radio and hearing these songs, hearing Bob O'Reilly all the time, and hearing Stairway to Heaven all the time, almost as much as contemporary rock songs. So when I was 12 or 13 years old, that's when I got these albums. I got Who's Next in the early 90s, and it became one of my favorite records. And it was also a touchstone for bands I liked at the time. You know, I was a big Pearl Jam fan at the time, and they would play Bob O'Reilly in their encores, you know, and a lot of bands have played Bob O'Reilly in their encores. So there was this sort of sense of, I think, connection between the old bands and the new bands that I don't think exists to the same degree today. I think that there's still bands that are new now that love The Who, but it's not as out front as it was maybe in the 90s with young rock bands.
Sure, and also, of course, in the early 90s, the rock bands themselves were at the forefront of pop culture themselves. So therefore, all of it was kind of pulled much closer to the forefront than perhaps it is now in some ways. The thing that I only recently truly realized is this obvious point is, you're absolutely right, in the late 80s, early 90s, I think that there was a feeling among, you know, probably suburban white teens, to be specific, that all this classic rock stuff was somehow sort of as current and relevant as new bands. Because of the prevalence of the classic rock format, there were, you know, among a certain breed of kids, there were tons of teenage fans of classic rock, which, by the way, is a phenomenon that continued and has not stopped. There's something about it. They're still on TikTok. There's a huge classic rock TikTok thing of kids getting into the actual bands they're into. Maybe shift. It tends to be Beatles more than it, I think it even was in the at that point. There, I don't see a lot of teenage Who fans right now, but
or Pink Floyd.
Yeah, Pink Floyd.
I was out recently at an amusement park outside of Minneapolis with my family, and I saw so many teenagers wearing Pink Floyd shirts. And I think it's partly to do with the music and partly with how every generation of teenagers smoke weed.
Yes.
So, you know, exactly. Pink Floyd is a part of that. They own that corner, so they're going to be eternal for that. You know, I was thinking about this just now, that when I first, you know, bought a cassette of Who's Next and Led Zeppelin 4 and all of these classic rock benchmark records, I mean, Who's Next was only 20 years old when
That's
I heard it.
Exactly where I was going, yes. Exactly.
Which, you know, is as old as Is This It, the Strokes record is now.
Exactly.
You know? Which seems weird to think about, because when I was a kid, it seemed way older than that. Like, the part of the appeal of classic rock to me was that it seemed like it was part of the earth or something. It was almost like as old as the blues or as old as anything else. And I'm sure maybe for kids now, someone who's 13 or 14 and hears the Strokes for the first time, maybe they feel the same way about that this is just music that's always been there and seems eternal. And maybe if you're not into pop music, the sort of ephemeral nature of pop, how it's here one moment and gone the next, if you want something that feels a little more eternal seeming, you're drawn to stuff like that. I mean, that was true for me as a kid. But it's just weird to think about that now, because there is a generation of kids who look at you know, Turn on the Bright Lights by Interpol, you know, in the same way that maybe people my age thought of Who's Next in Led Zeppelin 4.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
Probably the easiest thing I've ever done. The medication comes in the mail and it's very easy to use. I've been able to live my normal lifestyle and I've lost 20 pounds already and I've never felt better. It changed my life.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Our house is a mess. Come on in.
I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
It's, you read my mind, because that's literally what I was talking about. What I only recently kind of fully grasped is how short 20 years really is and how recent this music was in the late 80s and early 90s. And yes, it seemed ancient. The bands seemed, you know, ancient in sort of a good way, and they seemed like gods, you know, gods still walking the earth. And... And there's that famous graphic, of course, online, which is very sobering for anyone over the age of 30, where they show the ages of the Traveling Wilburys while they're in the Traveling Wilburys. And as old as those guys seemed, they're all like 46, 52 max. Like, I mean, it's utterly horrifying. Those guys were all younger than Tom Cruise, you know, like way right. Younger than Tom Cruise is now. So it's, I think time was... Steven Zant would say that chronological time doesn't apply to, in rock and roll, and he might be on to something. But there is some weird time warp thing, and it's weird to think somehow. I think the Strokes feel more contemporary to kids now than in some weird way than the classic rock stuff seemed in the early 80s, early 90s. I don't know if they seem like gods or just something that's still cool.
I think with the classic rock bands that there is this veneer of mythology that gets applied to a lot of those bands,
right,
that makes them seem older but also more mythic and larger than life. And in my book, I write about people like Roger Daltrey or Robert Plant being like comic book characters more than real life people, you know, that there was something almost akin to like Thor or Batman or Superman with those people, because, you know, there was the albums, there's the tell-all rock books that you read, you watch the documentaries, and it's just part of the era. It's also the way media works, that, you know, when I was first learning about music and reading about records, sometimes it would take 6, 7, 8 months for me to actually find the record that I was reading about. Like, I couldn't just look it up. So I had to imagine what it would be before I found it. And then when I actually did find it, it was, again, almost like a Lord of the Rings type journey. It was like, I finally found this record and now I can hear it, which isn't the same now. And obviously, I mean, I think it's better now. It's great that we have access to stuff so quickly, but it's also harder for things to have that same kind of romantic appeal in a way that maybe it did then. And that feeds into those albums, along with, you know, all the usual sort of baby boomer self-aggrandizing that goes on with classic rock, where it's like, this is the greatest music ever. And, you know, that kind of gets shoved down your throat. I think much more so when we were growing up than now.
But somehow I bought into that. Yeah.
And I bought into that because I really loved those bands. So, yeah, I didn't resist it really.
But for me, it always felt, I never felt like the stuff on classic radio as a kid. It never felt like sort of the big chill soundtrack where it just felt like this kind of like tinkly, like for me, that felt like boomer nostalgia, but somehow the classic rock stuff felt like the stuff of myth and legend that transcended mere generational boundaries. You know, like, so yeah. that was somehow, that was the, I realize for a lot of people that distinction doesn't exist, but I think for me, that was the case, you know.
Well, I remember hearing Baba O'Reilly, and like, what is Baba O'Reilly? Like, what does that even mean? And what is this weird synth part on here? And like, what is Roger Daltrey talking about? There was so much about it that did not make immediate sense. To me, that I think added to the allure of it. And it was also, I think for me, it was the portal to an adult world, you know, that these were adults, or at least they were like older brothers, you know, who were in college or something, who were living in a world of adventure and, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll and all those cliches that were very appealing to me as a pimple-faced teenager who was living in the Midwest and did not have a very exciting life. I mean, so I think that was part of it as well. You know, even like the covers of these albums, yes. You look at the cover of Who's Next and like there's this big building. It looks like a low rent version of the Monolith from 2001. And, you know, they're all taking a piss on it. And like, what does this mean? Is this like a metaphor? Is this a joke? You know, or like the cover of Led Zeppelin IV, the guy with the sticks on his back and it's on the wall with the wallpaper falling off. There were no answers to like what this stuff meant, but it was wondering what it meant. I think that added to the appeal of it.
Well, there was a, what in retrospect was a genuine attempt at both mysticism and spirituality in both of those albums and both of those bands. Pete was always writing about sort of mankind's spiritual potential is really the theme of this Lifehouse project, which again we'll get to, which is what Who's Next is a pale shadow in his mind of this insanely ambitious project he had. The whole Aleister Crowley thing and the Magic with a K thing that the Zeppelin guys were into lent this air to the whole thing that was irresistible to a certain kind of teenage mind. There was all this lore embedded in all of this stuff, and you're right, and that the idea of mysteries to solve that were hard to solve pre-internet, and even, you know, the fact that Led Zeppelin IV didn't have a title and Zoso and all that stuff, is all the runes and everything is just very, very enticing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about this. You know, I recently wrote a big thing about The Who for uprocks.com, and just comparing The Who and Led Zeppelin. And one thing I think that's interesting that links the bands is that they both have these auteurs at the center of the band. You have Jimmy Page in Zeppelin and you have Pete Townsend in The Who, but they operate in very different ways. You know, Jimmy Page in a way used Led Zeppelin as a wall between himself and the audience. And I think with Led Zeppelin, for me, it's first and foremost about the visceral power of how they sound and how that communicates what those songs are about, which is darkness and sex and power. And you listen to that and you feel the power, especially as a young person. You want to be as powerful as Led Zeppelin sounds, and you're never going to get there, but you listen to that band in order to feel that power. Whereas with The Who, they really are apart, I think, from like all the other arena rock bands in that they're this big, loud, brash rock band, but they have a strong singer-songwriter point of view at the center of it. Like, it is about one guy for the most part, except when John Entwistle is writing about spiders and, you know, being chased down by his wife. It's mostly about Pete Townsend and his identity crisis, his spiritual crisis, and trying to get to the bottom of that. And I think that's what connects people to The Who, that for all the great rock and roll they made and how larger than life they are, you can connect to them in the same way that you can connect to a Bob Dylan or Joni Mitchell. You know, you feel the authorial voice of Pete Townsend in that band. And I think that really sets them apart from like Zeppelin or Queen or any of the big 70s rock bands, even like a Pink Floyd. Because Roger Waters has that too, but he's usually writing about these big themes And it's not quite as, I think, intimate as like the Pete Townsend songs for The Who. Does that make sense?
I think that's right. I think the other thing that these bands and those albums have in common is that a couple things were being pushed forward. First of all, musicianship. You didn't have, up until around that time, 69 to 71, that around then, you know, around Woodstock, that you didn't have rhythm sections that played like that in rock and roll. And that kept getting better, because even like The Who itself or Zeppelin itself kept getting better. And so they were pushing past the bounds of what had been even possible in rock. And in both cases, really pushing right to the edge of prog, I would say. Those albums both are, it's like there's a, you know, I'm showing like sort of a ceiling, and they were starting to break through the ceiling of what would become progressive rock, and in many ways, but still staying within the bounds of what was kind of commercial and sort of acceptable to a broad audience without getting into like the, as much as I love prog, some of the excesses. So you're hearing those limits being pushed, and also, you know, recording, producing, engineering had hit a point where, you know, up until then, it's both sort of incidental to the cases of the bands themselves and also just broadly speaking, you know, like up until then, I've like argued with Neil Peart himself, who loves Tommy, and he thought there was nothing wrong with the sound of Tommy. But to me, there's definitely something wrong with the sound of Tommy.
Oh, yeah.
It sounds like it's recorded inside a cereal box, you know, compared to Who's Next. And so they kind of hit a point where everything was firing on enough levels that you could get a sound that you can't look back now. It's 1971, it's 50 years ago. And I don't think there's anything you would like change or improve about the way these both of those records were recorded, you know, or produced. Like they were able to hit their potential, whereas there is stuff, you know, there's a certain turning point. It's probably like Sgt. Pepper's Revolver. But before that, shit starts to sound dated sonically and limited sonically, where you kind of wish they could, you know, go back and make it sound as big and modern as things could sound. But by 1971, pretty big and modern, right? They kind of hit, as far as stereo recording of live bands, like kind of got it.
Yeah, and I feel like we have to give a shout out to Glenn Johns, who I believe worked on both of those records.
And his brother Andy. It's one family.
Yeah.
It's Glenn Johns and Andy Johns. It was Glenn on Who's Next, and he was too busy mostly recording Who's Next and other things, so he had his brother Andy, who was just as good as him, worked on Led Zeppelin 4. So we have to thank the Johns brothers for getting us there.
No, yeah, I think you're absolutely right about the progression in production that in 1971, you do see this perfect storm of bands hitting a certain peak with their songwriting and their musicianship and just the chemistry of the musicians, and also embracing technology in a way that still seemed fresh. You know, like the use of synthesizers on Who's Next. I mean, it was really ahead of its time for most of rock. I mean, obviously you had Yes, and like the progressive rock bands were going to be really leaning on that in the years ahead. But it hadn't quite taken over yet. It hadn't quite got to the point in the 70s, like where things were starting to get too slick and too sterile, you know, which was going to be happening, you know, as you get later on in the decade. It really was this great match of, we have this emerging technology and we're going to use it in a way that makes sense and doesn't dilute the raw power of these bands. And I think it's fair to say that rock production hasn't gotten better than what's on those records. Like I'm sure there's many bands out there today who are like, if we could only get John Bonham's drum sound, or if we could only get, you know, the synths, you know, like how good they sound on Who's Next. I feel like now those are two of the records that most bands would look at as like, we're trying to do that now, you know, rather than push beyond that. You know, at least rock bands of a certain ilk, you know, bands that are kind of working in that classic style, like that's the kind of production that they're going to aspire to. Like that, you know, I'd also say like the Black Sabbath records from that time sound like pretty perfect. And I mean, I love the Rolling Stones records from that time too, Sticky Fingers and Exile on Main Street. But yeah, that early 70s rock production is like pretty hard to beat.
Steve, you're talking about synthesizers, and that it's really interesting, obviously, the use of synth on Who's Next. Glyn Johns says in the Classic Albums documentary that he's pretty sure that's the first time anyone used synthesizers to kind of keep a rhythm, or to provide a rhythm that the band then plays to. And of course, that presages Giorgio Moroder and Kraftwerk and all sorts of things that people don't think of. If you're thinking of like Who's Next is this, classic rock thing, it you may not think of it in that lineage, but it actually is in that lineage as well. So there's my case to people who hate rock of why Who's Next is important. Is that even if you only care about Giorgio Moroder and Kraftwerk, which I can understand because it's pretty great, you have to reckon with Who's Next. So there, you have to listen to my wife if you love Giorgio Moroder. I'm sorry.
Well, we were talking earlier about the song Bob O'Reilly, and part of what that title references is the experimental musician Terry Riley, who was working with synths at that time, and he was an inspiration to Pete Townsend. And to your point, I mean, I think people look at Who's Next at this point as being this sort of like white bread, overexposed record that we've all heard a million times. But it is worth noting that I think in the moment, it actually was like a very forward-thinking record that was looking to experimental music of the time and bringing that into this arena rock context. And I don't think you can really undersell how those elements have kept that album alive, because, we're not talking about Grand Funk Railroad records at this time, even though Grand Funk Railroad was at least as popular as The Who, maybe more popular than The Who in 1971. Those records haven't endured in the same way as this album has, again, because I think it wasn't just regurgitating the standard rock influences even at that time. It was pushing forward, and in a way, it still sounds kind of weird. We've all heard these songs like in CSI episodes, so it's like really hard to like contextualize them in like kind of a fresh way. But yeah, I mean, I think there's like genuine weirdness and forward thinking and experimentation going on that album.
It's fun to talk a little bit about Lifehouse, something that's long fascinated me, and all credit to Pete Townsend, because so coming off of Tommy, he was he wanted to do another sort of even more ambitious rock opera film project. Just think of the kind of thing, artists now, like a Beyonce who wants to do a visual album and all sorts of things. And then kind of even, actually Kanye is a good example. It's like, someone like that is always going to be reaching for things that might be like literally impossible. I'm going to do, this album is also going to be a video game about my mother. And like, it's going to like just things that never happen because you're artistic reach is you can't quite grasp the things you're reaching for. And Pete Townsend was 100% like that. And so Lifehouse was a concept that he could not, and he blamed everyone around him for not understanding what he was trying to tell them. And his idea, he explained it best in the Classic Albums documentary, which is that he really liked the idea of the deaf, dumb, and blind boy from Tommy. And he literally was like, how can I sort of do that again? Which is hilarious, of course, because that's not really an idea you need to repeat. Like, you only get one deaf, dumb, and blind boy. But his idea was, well, what if someone was in what we would now call a virtual reality suit, and all they saw and experienced were the things created for them by the commercial world and by the, whoever was making all the content for the virtual reality suit, and they never experienced the real world, and therefore they were deaf, dumb, and blind to the real world. And now, and again, all credit to Pete Townsend, this now actually sounds like a fairly pedestrian idea, because it's, we've seen it a million times, and we've seen it in the Matrix, we've seen it in Ready Player One, we've seen it in, basically the internet itself, which certainly did not exist in 1971. So I think he really is a genius. Like, he really came up with this stuff. And so basically there was a film project and God knows what attached to this. And it was originally going to be a double album, concept album thing following this tale of Lifehouse that does have a story. You can look it up. And
when there was also those Young Vic shows that they played in early 1971. I don't know if you're familiar with those, but like The Who, they booked these shows at the Young Vic. It's a theater in London. And they were playing all the Who's Next songs, Won't Get Fooled Again and Getting in Tune, and also some songs that didn't make the record, like Pure and Easy and I Don't Even Know Myself. Don't pretend that you know me, 'cause I don't even know myself. which are songs that I think Who fans know really well. And if you don't know those songs, you should definitely seek them out. But basically, the idea was that they were just going to invite people off the street to these shows, and that Pete Townsend, his ambition would be that eventually the band would just be in the background and that the audience would be the stars of the show and that these characters would emerge and that somehow this would feed into the idea of there being like this mass consciousness. And I think he even had this thought that they would all live in the theater for, you know, several weeks and it'd be like this communal thing. And again, it was, I think, an idea that was tied with this very 60s utopianism that rock and roll can be a vehicle for improving society, and that this was in some way going to be the actualization of that. And of course, what actually happened was is that it was just like a bunch of drunks and vagrants that came off the street, and they all wanted to hear them play Magic Bus. You know, they didn't want to hear these songs that eventually became huge classics.
And by, I don't know about you, but the last song I want to hear, I always wanted to hear when I saw The Who was Magic Bus. I really didn't want them to play Magic Bus, but these fans were different.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it was really like the failure of those shows that prompted Pete Townsend to reconsider this whole grand concept that he had. And I think everyone around him, including people like Glenn Johns, I think they could see like how amazing these songs were, that like they didn't need a concept to put across. It's like, just record the songs, man. Like, you guys are a great band. Go in the studio, knock them out, and you're going to have a great record. But it's amazing like how for decades after the fact, like, Townsend could not let that go. It just seemed like he, like you said, looked at it as a failure on some level, because he didn't want to just make a great rock record. He wanted, I think, to change the world in some kind of way, which we laugh at now, but I think at that time, there was still this idea that music could do that.
That's right.
And it's so far beyond our comprehension, because it just seems idealistic to the point of, you know, naivete, you know, like, it doesn't
or
make
madness,
any sense.
Yeah.
Or madness, yeah.
Yeah.
And maybe 71 is significant also because people are starting to realize that, you know, that along with the great strides in music and art, it also is really, you're starting to see what they call the corporatization of music at that time. The idealism is falling out and people are realizing that this is a business. It's not something that is actually like a life-changing force necessarily.
Yeah, well, the irony is that the Young Vic shows, which, you know, there's a bunch of footage captured, and you've if you ever seen any Who documentaries, you've seen it. It's, you know, it's just pictured Keith Moon in the headphones and trying to play along to the synth tapes, and you know, there's some great performances captured. But the fact that the music honed in those utopian, bizarre Young Vic shows, where they actually got the venue for free, it was all experimental and communal and idealistic, that very music then sort of calcified into the sound of arena rock. We didn't talk about that aspect, but the arena circuit was just starting, and so The Who became a keystone of that. I'm a big defender of arena rock. I love arena rock. But it still was, you know, compared to, I've talked to people who've seen The Who at the Fillmore East, and I'm sure that was probably a pretty good experience too. And so they went from that to realizing like, oh, this can be a business. We can play arenas all across the country. It became a much bigger business. And that's what, you know, that's what they ended up inventing, was a sound for that. So I guess there is a small irony there, as much as I would defend arena rock as a thing.
Well, and I love arena rock too. And, you know, it is kind of inconceivable to me to see a band like The Who play a song like Bob O'Reilly in like a 1,200 person club. You know what I mean? Like, there's something about that song where
it demands the arena, right?
It demands the arena. It's almost impossible for me to imagine someone writing a song like that and not being like a huge megalomaniac, you know, right, a person who would insist on playing in front of 100,000 people, because like, how do you write a song that big and, you know, not want just to see a sea of people getting into it? You know, it just has that kind of sweep to it. And it's why I love that song so much. I mean, and truth be told, I have seen bands in clubs play that song. Like, I've seen Guided by Voices play that
right
song in front of like 250 people.
Right. Me
and
too,
it was
yeah
great. But part of the fun of it was almost seeing Robert Pollard play acting like he was in a stadium or an arena doing that song. Like, you could almost imagine him having the fantasy on stage in real time. Because how can you not when you play that song?
Everything that's eccentric, again, about this music, we just accept because we've always known it. But the fact that they got this dude to play a crazy long violin solo at the end of the song, because it's basically it was a guy who knew Keith Moon named David Arbus. And he was in a prog rock band called East of Eden. There we go with the prog. And, you know, he got called in to play that solo. So, you know, that's very strange. I'm not sure if there's a long climactic violin solo in any rock song that I can think of that's not by Dave Matthews. So it's just, but again, it's another thing that it took me years, because we were just sort of brainwashed with this stuff as this is the thing in Stone. It took me years to realize, like, wow, that's actually really weird. And it's cool, but why is there a violin solo? You know, and I think part of it, of course, is Pete Townsend's vision of himself as a composer, which goes back to the megalomania, but he was correct. He was a composer. And Roger said something interesting, which is that Pete always knew that this stuff was for the ages. Like, he was making classic rock before anyone else was kind of seeing it that way by that time. He thought this stuff would be around for decades, which you don't necessarily hear a lot.
Well, and I think it is because the songs, as much as we hear them, aren't as obvious as they seem. And there's aspects to the songs that I think hit people the 100th time they hear it. You know, you think of a song like Won't Get Fooled Again, which, again, I think that's the theme song of CSI Miami, or is it the original CSI? It's one of those shows. So you might just think of that as like, oh, that's the song where Roger Daltrey screams, and it's this, you know, arena rock song we've all heard a million times. But you get into the lyrics of it, and it's an incredibly cynical, and I think in many ways insightful song about politics. It's as cynical as any punk rock song that came about, you know, 6-7 years after Who's Next came out. And yet it's in the body of this enormous crowd-pleasing arena rock song. But, you know, like, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. I mean, there's not many Dylan lyrics, I think, that are as insightful as that about the nature of politics and leadership and as it existed in 1971 and as it exists now. I mean, you know, you hear that song and it's not any less relevant now than it was then.
Yeah, and it's a very sort of proto-Gen X cynicism, and one that would still piss off young activists, you know, because it's not an activist song. It's a song sneering at extremism in any direction, and it's not necessarily in tune with the times. It's a little bit looking past. It's almost like a post-Watergate type song written in the heat of, you know, 1971 and Vietnam War protests and everything else. It's interesting, and you can argue with the song too, you know.
But, yeah, I mean, I would almost say, like, it's not necessarily anti-activism as it is anti-power. The idea that, like, if you feel like you're going to step into a power structure and affect change that way, that power corrupts, and that anyone who gets into that will ultimately repeat the mistakes that other people did. So maybe the solution is to take the power structure apart. Maybe I'm giving Pete Townsend too much credit, but I think that's an interpretation of that song that could work. And look, we've seen that to be true time and again, you know, in the 50 years since that song has been written. And I think we'll see it after that you put certain people in the halls of power, and it just seems like the structure that's in place just corrupts people. And it's worth being cynical about that and maybe reconsidering an alternate path to change. Pete, if you're listening, I hope that is an accurate interpretation. I'd be curious to hear what he has to say about that.
I found some post-Trump solace, immediate post-Trump election solace in that song. You know, I thought of Pick Up My Guitar and Play just like yesterday. And I was like, look, you know, I find meaning in this stuff the same way I still find meaning in Star Wars. I don't care how many other millions of people have trod this stuff to death. I still, you know, so anyway. This really really something, and I agree with you to ponder what you said, that, you know, rock production, rock sounds didn't get much better than on Led Zeppelin 4 and Who's Next, and that was 50 years ago. I'm not going to get into like rock is dead debates with you for many reasons, but it does point to some of the challenges of the genre. When you have 50 years ago, you have a drum sound that really hasn't been bettered, specifically, I would say, on, you know, the John Bonham drum sound on Led Zeppelin 4, although Keith sounds pretty good on Who's Next too, and that was half a century ago.
Well, don't you think that's true of all genres, though? I mean, I feel like it's not really about innovation artistically, because, you know, sounds are just one thing. It's what you do with those sounds is, I think, where the progression and the innovation comes in. But I mean, I think I would say the same thing about R&B music too. I would say the same thing about dance music, like the sounds that they got in the 70s. I just think technology can only improve things so much before it starts to take things away. And maybe I'm going to start sounding like Jack White here or something. I mean, I'm not saying you have to record in a, you know, through a tin can or something for artistic purity, but I think that's just that's a bigger observation than just rock. I don't know.
I mean, I guess the difference is because if you play 80s hip hop to a kid who likes hip hop now, they think it sounds like something from like the Flintstones, you know? So it's sort of like whereas if you're someone who likes rock, and you play them this thing from 50 years ago, and even a kid, they're not gonna be like, that sounds ancient necessarily on a sonic level or on a, you know, or on any level really, you know? So that's the weird thing.
Yeah, although, I mean, there's a lot of music now that is emulating the sonic qualities of the past though, like even like the hippest, biggest hit makers, and even in hip hop, I mean, it's like drawing either through samples or just through like having sonic signifiers that are reminiscent of previous eras, but less so the 70s now. It's like more about the 80s and even 90s, you know, and that's just part of the cyclical nature of how these things work. But I mean, you know, getting back to Led Zeppelin 4, I do think it's true that, like, I think for a certain kind of like straightforward rock band, like not every rock band, I don't think like Coldplay or the Killers or, you know, a lot of bands like aren't emulating Led Zeppelin 4, but I mean,
basically it would be overkill to have the John Bonham drum sound on certain kinds of music. It would be ridiculous. Yes.
Right. I just think that for like a straightforward rock band where it's about four people playing together and creating like, again, the visceral sound that Led Zeppelin has, like heavy riffing rock with a tremendous rhythm section and a singer that like cuts over the top of it, it's hard to think of a better example of that than Led Zeppelin 4. And also the fact that that album has a lot of beautiful folky cuts as well. I mean, it gives you a little bit of everything. You go from Black Dog to The Battle of Evermore to When the Levee Breaks. It's a little bit of everything from a band that I think doesn't always get credit for how versatile they are. I mean, I think they're thought of as like one of the greatest hard rock bands of all time, but they actually played like a lot of different styles of music really, really well. And the fact that they could go from being this hell-raising blues rock band on their first couple of records to being a band that was like very indebted to like Fairport Convention on the third record, and then marrying those two sides on Led Zeppelin 4, I mean, it's a pretty incredible progression for that band over the course of like 2 or 3 years.
I feel like a song, I have a easier time hearing the freshness in some of the Who stuff than Stairway to Heaven. It's very hard. I can do it with some effort. It's very hard to kind of put yourself in the place and be like, I'm hearing this for the first time. What do I make of it?
You know,
because it's just so embedded in the culture that it gets very hard. But there is a bootleg recently escaped, a very low quality bootleg of the first time they played it live before anyone heard it. And that's really interesting because you can actually hear there's some people who are talking during it.
Right.
Which is
really
funny. And that cracked me up, and that helped me hear it fresh for the first time. That maybe it was a little hard to get over at first, because it takes a while to, you know, it's like Beavis and Butthead sitting there picking their noses until the rock part starts. So, you know, that's interesting.
Yeah, I'm sure they wanted to hear a whole lot of Love or, you know, Communication Breakdown. You know, they were just bored by this song that takes forever to get to the rocking part. I do find that with Led Zeppelin 4 that a lot of Zeppelin fans, I think, underrate this record because it is so familiar. And it is an album, again, that every single song is played on the radio. Like, even, like, Four Sticks and Misty Mountain Hop, some of the, like, less, like, some of the deep cuts on that record, like, I've heard those on the radio. And I find that when you talk to Zeppelin fans, they're quicker to say that Led Zeppelin 3 is their favorite, or Houses of the Holy is their favorite, or Physical Graffiti is their favorite. And those are all great records. But I think if you take away the familiarity of Led Zeppelin 4, it's pretty hard for me to put any other Zeppelin record above it, just because it does give you a little bit of everything in a more concise package than Physical Graffiti, for instance, which I love Physical Graffiti. And I have said that Physical Graffiti is my favorite Zeppelin record on occasion, but it's just hard to hear Zeppelin 4 with fresh ears, like you said, you know, to appreciate a song like Stairway to Heaven that I think is compositionally like pretty ingenious, like how that builds the different parts of it, or When the Levee Breaks. Which, I'm fascinated by the production of that record, just like how that sounds. It's a very weird sounding song, like what they do with the tracks. I'd love to see a classic albums documentary on Zeppelin 4. Like, Jimmy Page is like a pretty, you know, close to the vest type of person. He's someone I'd love to hear break down those records, how they made them, because there's certain sounds on those records that I don't understand, like how they got it or like what they're doing here. And it's similar to the Who's Next conversation we were having, that these albums that seem so obvious and so elemental in a way, there's a lot of eccentricity going on that we overlook just because they are so familiar. You know, I wish I could hear them with fresh ears, or just to know what it would be like to hear these albums for the first time again, because I think you'd pick up more stuff than we do now, having heard them like a million times.
You know, I've actually found that, and we should wrap in a minute, I've found that a great spatial audio mix, Dolby Atmos, done really well, I would say Abbey Road is the one example, does allow you to hear these things fresh. So I would like someone to do like a great Atmos mix of these records without ruining it.
Right.
So which is a big tall, because I've also heard some Atmos mixes that actually, there's one of a couple songs on Appetite for Destruction that absolutely ruined the songs. I will say, man, that like the beginning, I almost hesitate to say it we're talking about many years ago when I was in like eighth grade and I was just getting into music, but I can viscerally remember putting on a Sony Walkman with cassettes and playing Led Zeppelin 4, and maybe I remember hearing for the first time that there's a sound at the beginning of Black Dog, at the beginning of Led Zeppelin 4, which is basically like the tape whirring up. And it is, so there's that sound, and then the most incredible vocal that one of the most incredible vocals ever recorded, just that insane Robert Plant vocal a cappella with like all the echo in the world, blathering complete come on nonsense. Like the lyrics are, they don't hold up, do they, as poetry, you know, but as you said, there's some extraordinary power in it. I think that's an experience you can chase the whole rest of your listening life, is just hearing, is being hit with something like that. And there's not even any, you know, even before the instruments come in, there's just so much power in that. So, and to go against what we were saying before, yeah, 50 years ago, people are still chasing that sound, but it is extraordinary that it's half a century ago and it still sounds powerful. You know, and it's also just that we're getting into the history. Before that, there wasn't a century of, the 20th century is the first century of recorded music.
Right.
So we don't have a precedent to relating, we don't have a precedent for relating to 50-year-old recordings that much. You know, the first was like recordings from the 30s and the 80s, which was, you know, everyone had the Robert Johnson box set. So that's the earliest sort of precedent for 50-year-old recordings, is around the 70s or 80s is when you could really first even have 50-year-old recordings to listen to. So
yeah.
It's a pretty new phenomenon. So we don't have a precedent. And especially for the precedent that, as we said, that 50 years ago was around when they were making recordings that would still sound contemporary. So we don't have a precedent for relating to music that still sounds where the technology is totally acceptable to us. You don't have to apologize to a kid for playing it like, oh, this is going to sound old and kind of, you know, sorry for the tape hiss and the, you know, the shitty sounding drums. So it's really, really interesting and I think unexplored.
I mean, that was a big theme of my book, Twilight of the Gods, just talking about what you're saying about how this generation, they really are setting like a new bar, like with each decade that they're around, you know, like in the 80s, there was no such thing as like 40-year-old rock stars until this generation. Like people thought if you were in your 40s, you had to retire and, you know, go into a rest home somewhere. And then it was in your 50s, then in your 60s, then in your 70s, and then in your 80s. And, you know, like you were saying, in 1971, the idea that kids would have been listening to music from 1921 was totally inconceivable. Kids listening to music from like 1951, like 20 years earlier, would have, you know, no one would have done that. And yet there are kids who will go back to these records and find something in them and enjoy them. And it does leave open the question of like, well, how long can this last? Will there be people that care about the 60th anniversary of these records or the 70th anniversary? And I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I guess I'll care. Like, you and I will care because we'll always love these records. But it is fascinating to see how they age and continue to speak to new generations. And I think it's a positive thing. To me, the great thing about music is there's always new music to get excited about. And then there's always music from the past that's new to you that you're discovering. And then there's music that you've loved for a long time that becomes a part of your history that connects you to older versions of yourself. And really, I know for me, I have CDs that I owned when I was 15. I don't have anything else that I owned when I was 15. Those records are like the only connection I have to an old version of myself. And I appreciate that. It grounds me in a sense of self that I would lose and I'd feel sad if I lost that. So yeah, I'm curious to see how these age, but they're aging well so far.
Yeah, and it is weird because, you know, of course we're not sitting around putting on these records anything close to every day or even every few years personally, because they're playing in my head permanently. But it's fun every few years, maybe even ever, to actually put it on and see if what's in my head matches what was actually recorded. So, yeah.
Yeah, I just listened to a bunch of Who because I just wrote this thing for Uproxx, and I hadn't listened to the Who in a while, and holds up. It holds up really, really well. So if you haven't heard either one of these records in a while, put them on. I think you'll still enjoy them.
So this has been today's episode of Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm Brian Hyatt. Thanks so much to Stephen Hayden for joining me. His most recent book is This Isn't Happening, a book about the making of Kid A and much more. He also co-hosts the IndieCast podcast. And Rolling Stone Music Now will be back next week here on Sirius XM's Volume, Channel 106. In the meantime, we are, of course, a podcast. Download Rolling Stone Music Now wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to Rolling Stone Music Now wherever you get your podcasts. Maybe leave us a nice review on Apple Podcasts. That's always specifically appreciated. But as always, thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.
Thank you.